3. The Old Testament and Science Findings. Few of the subjects dealt with in the Old Testament, and likewise the Gospels, give rise to a confrontation with the data of modern knowledge. When an incompatibility does occur between the biblical text and science, however, it is on extremely important points. As we have already seen in the preceding chapter, historical errors were found in the Bible, and we have quoted several of these pinpointed by Jewish and Christian experts in exegesis. The latter have naturally had a tendency to minimize the importance of such errors. They find it quite natural for a sacred author to present historical fact in accordance with theology and to write history to suit certain needs. We shall see further on, in the case of the Gospel according to Matthew, the same liberties taken with reality and the same commentaries aimed at making admissible as reality what is in contradiction to it. A logical and objective mind cannot be content with this procedure. From a logical angle, it is possible to single out a large number of contradictions and improbabilities. The existence of different sources that might have been used in the writing of a description may be at the origin of two different presentations of the same fact. This is not all. Different adaptations, later additions to the text itself, like the commentaries added a posteriori, then included in the text later on when a new copy was made, these are perfectly recognized by specialists in textual criticism, and very frankly underlined by some of them. In the case of the Pentateuch alone, for example, Father de Vaux in the general introduction preceding his translation of Genesis pages 13 and 14, has drawn attention to numerous disagreements. We shall not quote them here since we shall be quoting several of them later on in this study. The general impression one gains is that one must not follow the text to the letter. Here is a very typical example. In Genesis 6:3, God decides just before the flood henceforth to limit man's lifespan to 120 years, his days shall be 120 years. Further on, however, we note in Genesis 11:10-32, that the 10 descendants of Noah had lifespans that range from 148 to 600 years, see table in this chapter showing Noah's descendants down to Abraham. The contradiction between these two passages is quite obvious. The explanation is elementary. The first passage, Genesis 6:3, is a Yahvist text, probably dating as we have already seen from the 10th century before Christ. The second passage in Genesis 11:10-32, is a much more recent text, 6th century before Christ, from the sacerdotal version. This version is at the origin of these genealogies, which are as precise in their information on lifespans as they are improbable when taken en masse. It is in Genesis that we find the most evident incompatibilities with modern science. These concern three essential points: 1. The creation of the world and its stages. 2. The date of the creation of the world and the date of man's appearance on earth. 3. The description of the flood. The creation of the world. As Father de Vaux points out, Genesis starts with two juxtaposed descriptions of the creation. When examining them from the point of view of their compatibility with modern scientific data, we must look at each one separately. First, description of the creation. The first description occupies the first chapter and the very first verses of the second chapter. It is a masterpiece of inaccuracy from a scientific point of view. It must be examined one paragraph at a time. The text reproduced here is from the Revised Standard Version of the Bible. Publisher W. M. Collins & Sons for the British and Foreign Bible Society, 1952. Chapter 1, Verses 1 and 2, In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was moving over the face of the waters. It is quite possible to admit that before the creation of the earth, what was to become the universe as we know it was covered in darkness. To mention the existence of water at this period is, however, quite simply pure imagination. We shall see in the third part of this book how there is every indication that at the initial stage of the formation of the universe a gaseous mass existed. it is an error to place water in it. Verses 3 to 5, And God said, Let there be light, and there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening and there was morning, one day. The light circulating in the universe is the result of complex reactions in the stars. We shall come back to them in the third part of this work. At this stage in the creation, however, according to the Bible, the stars were not yet formed. The lights of the firmament are not mentioned in Genesis until verse 14, when they were created on the fourth day, to separate the day from the night, to give light upon earth, all of which is accurate. It is illogical, however, to mention the result, light, on the first day, when the cause of this light was created 3 days later. The fact that the existence of evening and morning is placed on the first day is, moreover, purely imaginary. The existence of evening and morning as elements of a single day is only conceivable after the creation of the earth and its rotation under the light of its own star, the sun. Verses 6 to 8, And God said, Let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters. And God made the firmament and separated the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. And it was so. And God called the firmament heaven. And there was evening and there was morning, a second day. The myth of the waters is continued here with their separation into two layers by a firmament that in the description of the flood allows the waters above to pass through and flow onto the earth. This image of the division of the waters into two masses is scientifically unacceptable. Verses 9 to 13, And God said, Let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered together he called seas. And God saw that it was good. And God said, Let the earth put forth vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind upon the earth. And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed according to their own kinds, and trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, a third day. The fact that continents emerged at the period in the Earth's history, when it was still covered with water, is quite acceptable scientifically. What is totally untenable is that a highly organized vegetable kingdom with reproduction by seed could have appeared before the existence of the sun. In Genesis it does not appear until the fourth day, and likewise the establishment of alternating nights and days. Verses 14 to 19, And God said, Let there be lights in the firmaments of the heavens to separate the day from night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years, and let them be lights in the firmament of the heavens to give light upon the earth. And it was so. And God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, and the lesser light to rule the night, he made the stars also. And God set them in the firmament of the heavens to give light upon earth, to rule over the day and over the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, a fourth day. Here the biblical author's description is acceptable. The only criticism one could level at this passage is the position it occupies in the description as a whole. Earth and moon emanated, as we know, from their original star, the sun. To place the creation of the sun and moon after the creation of the earth is contrary to the most firmly established ideas on the formation of the elements of the solar system. Verses 20 to 30, And God said, Let the waters bring forth swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the firmament of the heavens. So God created the great sea monsters and every living creature that moves, with which the waters swarm, according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, Be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters in the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth. And there was evening and there was morning, a fifth day. This passage contains assertions which are unacceptable. According to Genesis, the animal kingdom began with the appearance of creatures of the sea and winged birds. The biblical description informs us that it was not until the next day, as we shall see in the following verses, that the earth itself was populated by animals. It is certain that the origins of life came from the sea, but this question will not be dealt with until the third part of this book. From the sea, the earth was colonized, as it were, by the animal kingdom. It is from animals living on the surface of the earth, and in particular from one species of reptile which lived in the second era, that it is thought the birds originated. Numerous biological characteristics common to both species make this deduction possible. The beasts of the earth are not, however, mentioned until the sixth day in Genesis, after the appearance of the birds. This order of appearance, beasts of the earth after birds, is not therefore acceptable. Verses 24-31, "And God said, Let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds, cattle and creeping things and beasts of the earth according to their kinds. And it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth according to their kinds and the cattle according to their kinds, and everything that creeps upon the ground according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion, sic, over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. So God created man in his own image, in the image of God he created him, male and female he created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. And God said, Behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed which is upon the face of the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit, you shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food. And it was so. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening and there was morning, a sixth day. This is the description of the culmination of the creation. The author lists all the living creatures not mentioned before and describes the various kinds of food for man and beast. As we have seen, the error was to place the appearance of beasts of the earth after that of the birds. Man's appearance is, however, correctly situated after the other species of living things. The description of the creation finishes in the first three verses of chapter 2, "Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host, sick, of them. And on the seventh day God finished his work which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and hallowed it, because on it God rested from all his work which he had done in creation. These are the generations of the heavens and the earth when they were created." This description of the seventh day calls for some comment. Firstly, the meaning of certain words. The text is taken from the Revised Standard Version of the Bible mentioned above. The word host signifies here, in all probability, the multitude of beings created. As for the expression he rested, it is a manner of translating the Hebrew word Shabbath, from which the Jewish day for rest is derived, hence the expression in English Sabbath. It is quite clear that the rest that God is said to have taken after his 6 days' work is a legend. There is nevertheless an explanation for this. We must bear in mind that the description of the creation examined here is taken from the so-called sacerdotal version, written by priests and scribes who were the spiritual successors of Ezekiel, the prophet of the exile to Babylon, writing in the 6th century before Christ. We have already seen how the priests took the Yahvist and Elohist versions of Genesis and remodeled them after their own fashion in accordance with their own preoccupations. Father DeVaux has written that the legalist character of these writings was very essential. An outline of this has already been given above. Whereas the Yahvist text of the creation, written several centuries before the sacerdotal text, makes no mention of God's Sabbath, taken after the fatigue of a week's labor. The authors of the sacerdotal text bring it into their description. They divide the latter into separate days, with the very precise indication of the days of the week. They build it around the sabbatic day of rest, which they have to justify to the faithful by pointing out that God was the first to respect it. Subsequent to this practical necessity, the description that follows has an apparently logical religious order, but in fact scientific data permit us to qualify the latter as being of a whimsical nature. The idea that successive phases of the creation, as seen by the sacerdotal authors in their desire to incite people to religious observation, could have been compressed into the space of 1 week is one that cannot be defended from a scientific point of view. Today we are perfectly aware that the formation of the universe and the earth took place in stages that lasted for very long periods. In the third part of the present work, we shall examine this question when we come to look at the Quranic data concerning the creation. Even if the description came to a close on the evening of the sixth day, without mentioning the seventh day, the Sabbath when God is said to have rested, and even if, as in the Quranic description, we were permitted to think that they were in fact undefined periods rather than actual days, the sacerdotal description would still not be any more acceptable. The succession of episodes it contains is an absolute contradiction with elementary scientific knowledge. It may be seen, therefore, that the sacerdotal description of the creation stands out as an imaginative and ingenious fabrication. Its purpose was quite different from that of making the truth known. Second description. The second description of the creation in Genesis follows immediately upon the first without comment or transitional passage. It does not provoke the same objections. We must remember that this description is roughly 3 centuries older and is very short. It allows more space to the creation of man and earthly paradise than to the creation of the earth and heavens. It mentions this very briefly, chapter 2, 4-7, in the day that Yahweh God made the earth and the heavens, when no plant of the field was yet in the earth and no herb of the field had yet sprung up, for Yahweh God had not caused it to rain upon the earth, and there was no man to till the ground, but a flood went up from earth and watered the whole face of the ground. Then Yahweh God formed man of dust from the ground, and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being. This is the Yahvist text that appears in the text of present-day Bibles. The sacerdotal text was added to it later on, but one may ask if it was originally so brief. Nobody is in a position to say whether the Yahvist text has not, in the course of time, been pared down. We do not know if the few lines we possess represent all that the oldest biblical text of the creation had to say. The Yahvist description does not mention the actual formation of the earth or the heavens. It makes it clear that when God created man, there was no vegetation on earth, it had not yet rained, even though the waters of the earth had covered its surface. The sequel to the text confirms this: God planted a garden at the same time as man was created. The vegetable kingdom therefore appears on earth at the same time as man. This is scientifically inaccurate. Man did not appear on earth until a long time after vegetation had been growing on it. We do not know how many hundreds of millions of years separate the two events. This is the only criticism that one can level at the Yahvist text. The fact that it does not place the creation of man in time in relation to the formation of the world and the earth, unlike the sacerdotal text, which places them in the same week, frees it from the serious objections raised against the latter. The date of the world's creation and the date of man's appearance on earth. The Jewish calendar, which follows the data contained in the Old Testament, places the dates of the above very precisely. The second half of the Christian year 1975 corresponds to the beginning of the 536th year of the creation of the world. The creation of man followed several days later, so that he has the same numerical age, counted in years, as in the Jewish calendar. There is probably a correction to be made on account of the fact that time was originally calculated in lunar years, while the calendar used in the West is based on solar years. This correction would have to be made if one wanted to be absolutely exact, but as it represents only 3%, it is of very little consequence. To simplify our calculations, it is easier to disregard it. What matters here is the order of magnitude. It is therefore of little importance if, over 1,000 years, our calculations are 30 years out. We are nearer the truth in following this Hebraic estimate of the creation of the world if we say that it happened roughly 37 centuries before Christ. What does modern science tell us? It would be difficult to reply to the question concerning the formation of the universe. All we can provide figures for is the era in time when the solar system was formed. It is possible to arrive at a reasonable approximation of this. The time between it and the present is estimated at 4.5 billion years. We can therefore measure the margin separating the firmly established reality we know today and the data taken from the Old Testament. We shall expand on this in the third part of the present work. These facts emerge from a close scrutiny of the biblical text. Genesis provides very precise information on the time that elapsed between Adam and Abraham. For the period from the time of Abraham to the beginnings of Christianity, the information provided is insufficient. It must be supported by other sources. 1. From Adam to Abraham. Genesis provides extremely precise genealogical data in chapters 4, 5, 11, 21, and 25. They concern all of Abraham's ancestors in direct line back to Adam. They give the length of time each person lived, the father's age at the birth of the son, and thus make it easily possible to ascertain the dates of birth and death of each ancestor in relation to the creation of Adam, as the table indicates. All the data used in this table come from the sacerdotal text of Genesis, the only biblical text that provides information of this kind. It may be deduced, according to the Bible, that Abraham was born 1948 years after Adam. 2. From Abraham to the beginnings of Christianity. The Bible does not provide any numerical information on this period that might lead to such precise estimates as those found in Genesis on Abraham's ancestors. We must look to other sources to estimate the time separating Abraham from Jesus. At present, allowing for a slight margin of error, the time of Abraham is situated at roughly 18 centuries before Jesus. Combined with information in Genesis on the interval separating Abraham and Adam, this would place Adam at roughly 38 centuries before Jesus. This estimate is undeniably wrong. The origins of this inaccuracy arise from the mistakes in the Bible on the Adam-Abraham period. The Jewish tradition still founds its calendar on this. Nowadays, we can challenge the traditional defenders of biblical truth with the incompatibility between the whimsical estimates of Jewish priests living in the 6th century before Christ and modern data. For centuries, the events of antiquity relating to Jesus were situated in time according to information based on these estimates. Before modern times, editions of the Bible frequently provided the reader with a preamble explaining the historical sequence of events that had come to pass between the creation of the world and the time when the books were edited. The figures vary slightly according to the time. For example, the Clementine Vulgate, 1621, gave this information, although it did place Abraham a little earlier and the creation at roughly the 40th century. Walton's Polyglot Bible, produced in the 17th century, in addition to biblical texts in several languages, gave the reader tables similar to the one shown here for Abraham's ancestors. Almost all the estimates coincide with the figures given here. With the arrival of modern times, editors were no longer able to maintain such whimsical chronologies without going against scientific discovery that placed the creation at a much earlier date. They were content to abolish these tables and preambles, but they avoided warning the reader that the biblical texts on which these chronologies were based had become obsolete, and could no longer be considered to express the truth. They preferred to draw a modest veil over them, and invent set phrases of cunning dialectics that would make acceptable the text as it had formerly been, without any subtractions from it. This is why the genealogies contained in the sacerdotal text of the Bible are still honored, even though in the 20th century one cannot reasonably continue to count time on the basis of such fiction. Modern scientific data do not allow us to establish the date of man's appearance on Earth beyond a certain limit. We may be certain that man, with the capacity for action and intelligent thought that distinguishes him from beings that appear to be anatomically similar to him, existed on Earth after a certain estimable date. Nobody, however, can say at what exact date he appeared. What we can say today is that remains have been found of a humanity capable of human thought and action whose age may be calculated in tens of thousands of years. This approximate dating refers to the prehistoric human species, the most recently discovered being the Cro-Magnon man. There have, of course, been many other discoveries all over the world of remains that appear to be human. These relate to less highly evolved species, and their age could be somewhere in the hundreds of thousands of years. But were they genuine men? Whatever the answer may be, scientific data are sufficiently precise concerning the prehistoric species like the Cro-Magnon man, to be able to place them much further back than the epoch in which Genesis places the first men. There is therefore an obvious incompatibility between what we can derive from the numerical data in Genesis about the date of man's appearance on Earth and the firmly established facts of modern scientific knowledge. The Flood. Chapters 6, 7, and 8 are devoted to the description of the flood. In actual fact, there are two descriptions. They have not been placed side by side, but are distributed all the way through. Passages are interwoven to give the appearance of a coherent succession of varying episodes. In these three chapters there are, in reality, blatant contradictions. Here again the explanation lies in the existence of two quite distinct sources, the Yahvist and sacerdotal versions. It has been shown earlier that they formed a disparate amalgam. Each original text has been broken down into paragraphs or phrases, elements of one source alternating with the other, so that in the course of the complete description, we go from one to another 17 times in roughly 100 lines of English text. Taken as a whole, the story goes as follows: man's corruption had become widespread, so God decided to annihilate him along with all the other living creatures. He warned Noah and told him to construct the ark into which he was to take his wife, his three sons and their wives, along with other living creatures. The two sources differ for the latter. One passage, sacerdotal, says that Noah was to take one pair of each species. Then in the passage that follows, Yahvist, it is stated that God ordered him to take seven males and seven females from each of the so-called pure animal species, and a single pair from the impure species. Further on, however, it is stated that Noah actually took one pair of each animal. Specialists, such as Father de Vaux, state that the passage in question is from an adaptation of the Yahvist description. Rainwater is given as the agent of the flood in one, Yahvist, passage, but in another, sacerdotal, the flood is given a double cause, rainwater and the waters of the earth. The earth was submerged right up to and above the mountain peaks. All life perished. After 1 year, when the waters had receded, Noah emerged from the ark that had come to rest on Mount Ararat. One might add that the flood lasted differing lengths of time according to the source used, 40 days for the Yahvist version and 150 in the sacerdotal text. The Yahvist version does not tell us when the event took place in Noah's life, but the sacerdotal text tells us that he was 600 years old. The latter also provides information in its genealogies that situates him in relation to Adam and Abraham. If we calculate according to the information contained in Genesis, Noah was born 1056 years after Adam, see Table of Abraham's genealogy, and the flood therefore took place 1656 years after the creation of Adam. In relation to Abraham, Genesis places the flood 292 years before the birth of this patriarch. According to Genesis, the flood affected the whole of the human race and all living creatures created by God on the face of the earth were destroyed. Humanity was then reconstituted by Noah's three sons and their wives, so that when Abraham was born roughly three centuries later, he found a humanity that was already reformed into separate communities. How could this reconstruction have taken place in such a short time? This simple observation deprives the narration of all verisimilitude. Furthermore, historical data show its incompatibility with modern knowledge. Abraham is placed in the period 1800 to 1850 before Christ, and if the flood took place, as Genesis suggests in its genealogies, roughly 3 centuries before Abraham, we would have to place him somewhere in the 21st to 22nd century before Christ. Modern historical knowledge confirms that at this period, civilizations had sprung up in several parts of the world, for their remains have been left to posterity. In the case of Egypt, for example, the remains correspond to the period preceding the Middle Kingdom, 2100 before Christ, at roughly the date of the first intermediate period before the 11th dynasty. In Babylonia, it is the third dynasty at Ur. We know for certain that there was no break in these civilizations, so that there could have been no destruction affecting the whole of humanity, as it appears in the Bible. We cannot therefore consider that these three biblical narrations provide man with an account of facts that correspond to the truth. We are obliged to admit that, objectively speaking, the texts which have come down to us do not represent the expression of reality. We may ask ourselves whether it is possible for God to have revealed anything other than the truth. It is difficult to entertain the idea that God taught to man ideas that were not only fictitious, but contradictory. We naturally arrive therefore at the hypothesis that distortions occurred that were made by man or that arose from traditions passed down from one generation to another by word of mouth, or from the texts of these traditions once they were written down. When one knows that a work such as Genesis was adapted at least twice over a period of not less than 3 centuries, it is hardly surprising to find improbabilities or descriptions that are incompatible with reality. This is because the progress made in human knowledge has enabled us to know, if not everything, enough at least about certain events to be able to judge the degree of compatibility between our knowledge and the ancient descriptions of them. There is nothing more logical than to maintain this interpretation of biblical errors which only implicates man himself. It is a great pity that the majority of commentators, both Jewish and Christian, do not hold with it. The arguments they use nevertheless deserve careful attention. 4. Position of Christian authors with regard to scientific error in the biblical texts. A critical examination. One is struck by the diverse nature of Christian commentators' reactions to the existence of these accumulated errors, improbabilities, and contradictions. Certain commentators acknowledge some of them, and do not hesitate in their work to tackle thorny problems. Others pass lightly over unacceptable statements and insist on defending the text word for word. The latter try to convince people by apologetic declarations, heavily reinforced by arguments which are often unexpected, in the hope that what is logically unacceptable will be forgotten. In the introduction to his translation of Genesis, Father de Vaux acknowledges the existence of critical arguments and even expands upon their cogency. Nevertheless, for him the objective reconstitution of past events has little interest. As he writes in his notes, the fact that the Bible resumes the memory of one or two disastrous floods of the valleys of the Tigris and Euphrates, enlarged by tradition until they took on the dimensions of a universal cataclysm, is neither here nor there. The essential thing is, however, that the sacred author has infused into this memory eternal teachings on the justice and mercy of God toward the malice of man and the salvation of the righteous. In this way, justification is found for the transformation of a popular legend into an event of divine proportions, and it is as such that it is thought fit to present the legend to men's faith, following the principle that an author has made use of it to illustrate religious teachings. An apologetic position of this kind justifies all the liberties taken in the composition of writings which are supposed to be sacred and to contain the word of God. If one acknowledges such human interference in what is divine, all the human manipulations of the biblical texts will be accounted for. If there are theological intentions, all manipulations become legitimate, so that those of the sacerdotal authors of the 6th century are justified, including their legalist preoccupations that turned into the whimsical descriptions we have already seen. A large number of Christian commentators have found it more ingenious to explain errors, improbabilities and contradictions in biblical descriptions by using the excuse that the biblical authors were expressing ideas in accordance with the social factors of a different culture or mentality. From this arose the definition of respective literary genres, which was introduced into the subtle dialectics of commentators, so that it accounts for all difficulties. Any contradictions there are between two texts are then explained by the difference in the way each author expressed ideas in his own particular literary genre. This argument is not, of course, acknowledged by everybody because it lacks gravity. It has not entirely fallen into disuse today, however, and we shall see in the New Testament its extravagant use as an attempt to explain blatant contradictions in the Gospels. Another way of making acceptable what would be rejected by logic when applied to a litigious text, is to surround the text in question with apologetical considerations. The reader's attention is distracted from the crucial problem of the truth of the text itself and deflected towards other problems. Cardinal Danielou's reflections on the flood follow this mode of expression. They appear in the Review Living God, Dieu Vivant No. 38, 1974, pages 95-112, under the title, Flood, Baptism, Judgment, Deluge, Baptum, Jugement, where he writes the oldest tradition of the Church has seen in the theology of the flood an image of Christ and the Church. It is an episode of great significance, a judgment striking the whole human race. Having quoted from Origen in his homilies on Ezekiel, he talks of the shipwreck of the entire universe saved in the ark. Cardinal Danielou dwells upon the value of the number 8, expressing the number of people that were saved in the ark, Noah and his wife, his three sons and their wives. He turns to his own use Justin's writings in his dialogue. They represent the symbol of the eighth day when Christ rose from the dead, and Noah, the firstborn of a new creation, is an image of Christ who was to do in reality what Noah had prefigured. He continues the comparison between Noah on the one hand, who was saved by the ark made of wood and the water that made it float, water of the flood from which a new humanity was born, and on the other, the cross made of wood. He stresses the value of this symbolism and concludes by underlining the spiritual and doctrinal wealth of the sacrament of the flood. Sic. There is much that one could say about such apologetical comparisons. We should always remember that they are commentaries on an event that it is not possible to defend as reality, either on a universal scale or in terms of the time in which the Bible places it. With a commentary such as Cardinal Danielou's, we are back in the Middle Ages, where the text had to be accepted as it was, and any discussion, other than conformist, was off the point. It is nevertheless reassuring to find that prior to that age of imposed obscurantism, highly logical attitudes were adopted. One might mention those of St. Augustine, which proceed from his thought, that was singularly advanced for the age he lived in. At the time of the Fathers of the Church, there must have been problems of textual criticism, because St. Augustine raises them in his letter No. 82. The most typical of them is the following passage: "It is solely to those books of Scripture which are called canonic that I have learned to grant such attention and respect that I firmly believe that their authors have made no errors in writing them. When I encounter in these books a statement which seems to contradict reality, I am in no doubt that either the text of my copy is faulty, or that the translator has not been faithful to the original, or that my understanding is deficient." It was inconceivable to St. Augustine that a sacred text might contain an error. St. Augustine defined very clearly the dogma of infallibility when, confronted with a passage that seemed to contradict the truth, he thought of looking for its cause, without excluding the hypothesis of a human fault. This is the attitude of a believer with a critical outlook. In St. Augustine's day, there was no possibility of a confrontation between the biblical text and science. An open-mindedness akin to his would today eliminate a lot of the difficulties raised by the confrontation of certain biblical texts with scientific knowledge. Present-day specialists, on the contrary, go to great trouble to defend the biblical text from any accusation of error. In his introduction to Genesis, Father De Vaux explains the reasons compelling him to defend the text at all costs, even if, quite obviously, it is historically or scientifically unacceptable. He asks us not to view biblical history according to the rules of historical study observed by people today, as if the existence of several different ways of writing history was possible. History, when it is told in an inaccurate fashion, as anyone will admit, becomes a historical novel. Here, however, it does not have to comply with the standards established by our conceptions. The biblical commentator rejects any verification of biblical descriptions through geology, paleontology, or prehistorical data. The Bible is not answerable to any of these disciplines, and were one to confront it with the data obtained from these sciences, it would only lead to an unreal opposition or an artificial concordance. Introduction to Genesis, page 35. One might point out that these reflections are made on what, in Genesis, is in no way in harmony with modern scientific data, in this case the first 11 chapters. When, however, in the present day, a few descriptions have been perfectly verified, in this case certain episodes from the time of the patriarchs, the author does not fail to support the truth of the Bible with modern knowledge. The doubt cast upon these descriptions should yield to the favorable witness that history and Eastern archaeology bear them. Ibid, page 34. In other words, if science is useful in confirming the biblical description, it is invoked, but if it invalidates the latter, reference to it is not permitted. To reconcile the irreconcilable, that is, the theory of the truth of the Bible with the inaccurate nature of certain facts reported in the descriptions in the Old Testament, modern theologians have applied their efforts to a revision of the classical concepts of truth. It lies outside the scope of this book to give a detailed expose of the subtle ideas that are developed at length in works dealing with the truth of the Bible, such as Olaretz's work, 1972, What is the Truth of the Bible? Publisher Le Centurion, Paris. This judgment concerning science will have to suffice. The author remarks that the Second Vatican Council has avoided providing rules to distinguish between error and truth in the Bible. Basic considerations show that this is impossible, because the Church cannot determine the truth or otherwise of scientific methods in such a way as to decide in principle and on a general level the question of the truth of the Scriptures. It is obvious that the Church is not in a position to make a pronouncement on the value of scientific method as a means of access to knowledge. The point here is quite different. It is not a question of theories, but of firmly established facts. In our day and age, it is not necessary to be highly learned to know that the world was not created 37 or 38 centuries ago. We know that man did not appear then and that the biblical genealogies on which this estimate is based have been proven wrong beyond any shadow of a doubt. The author quoted here must be aware of this. His statements on science are only aimed at sidestepping the issue so that he does not have to deal with it the way he ought to. The reminder of all these different attitudes adopted by Christian authors when confronted with the scientific errors of biblical texts is a good illustration of the uneasiness they engender. It recalls the impossibility of defining a logical position other than by recognizing their human origins and the impossibility of acknowledging that they form part of a revelation. The uneasiness prevalent in Christian circles concerning the revelation became clear at the Second Vatican Council, 1962-1965, where it took no less than 5 drafts before there was any agreement on the final text, after 3 years of discussions. It was only then that this painful situation threatening to engulf the Council came to an end, to use his Grace Weber's expression in his introduction to the Conciliar Document No. 4 on the Revelation Pub. Le Centurion, 1966, Paris. 2 sentences in this document concerning the Old Testament, chapter 4, page 53, describe the imperfections and obsolescence of certain texts in a way that cannot be contested. In view of the human situation prevailing before Christ's foundation of salvation, the books of the Old Testament enable everybody to know who is God and who is man, and also the way in which God, in his justice and mercy, behaves towards men. These books, even though they contain material which is imperfect and obsolete, nevertheless bear witness to truly divine teachings. There is no better statement than the use of the adjectives imperfect and obsolete applied to certain texts, to indicate that the latter are open to criticism and might even be abandoned, the principle is very clearly acknowledged. This text forms part of a general declaration which was definitively ratified by 2,344 votes to 6. Nevertheless, one might question this almost total unanimity. In actual fact, in the commentaries of the official document signed by His Grace Weber, there is one phrase in particular which obviously corrects the solemn affirmation of the Council on the obsolescence of certain texts. Certain books of the Jewish Bible have a temporary application and have something imperfect in them. Obsolete, the expression used in the official declaration, is hardly a synonym for temporary application, to use the commentator's phrase. As for the epithet Jewish which the latter curiously adds, it suggests that the conciliar text only criticized the version in Hebrew. This is not at all the case. It is indeed the Christian Old Testament alone that, at the Council, was the object of a judgment concerning the imperfection and obsolescence of certain parts. 5. Conclusions. The biblical scriptures must be examined without being embellished artificially with qualities one would like them to have. They must be seen objectively as they are. This implies not only a knowledge of the texts, but also of their history. The latter makes it possible to form an idea of the circumstances which brought about textual adaptations over the centuries, the slow formation of the collection that we have today, with its numerous subtractions and additions. The above makes it quite possible to believe that different versions of the same description can be found in the Old Testament, as well as contradictions, historical errors, improbabilities and incompatibilities with firmly established scientific data. They are quite natural in human works of a very great age. How could one fail to find them in the books written in the same conditions in which the biblical text was composed? At a time when it was not yet possible to ask scientific questions, and one could only decide on improbabilities or contradictions, a man of good sense, such as Saint Augustine, considered that God could not teach man things that did not correspond to reality. He therefore put forward the principle that it was not possible for an affirmation contrary to the truth to be of divine origin, and was prepared to exclude from all the sacred texts anything that appeared to him to merit exclusion on these grounds. Later, at a time when the incompatibility of certain passages of the Bible with modern knowledge has been realized, the same attitude has not been followed. This refusal has been so insistent that a whole literature has sprung up, aimed at justifying the fact that, in the face of all opposition, texts have been retained in the Bible that have no reason to be there. The Second Vatican Council, 1962-1965, has greatly reduced this uncompromising attitude by introducing reservations about the books of the Old Testament which contain material that is imperfect and obsolete. One wonders if this will remain a pious wish or if it will be followed by a change in attitude towards material which, in the 20th century, is no longer acceptable in the books of the Bible. In actual fact, save for any human manipulation, the latter were destined to be the witness of true teachings coming from God.